Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of UFOs and the Paranormal Over Our Heads. I'm your host, Preston Dennett, and each week we, of course, explore a different aspect of UFOs and the paranormal. And tonight we're going to be talking about cryptozoology, specifically in the state of Indiana. Our guest is cryptozoologist, author, and researcher Michael Newton, and we're going to be discussing his very, very interesting book, which I have just finished reading for the second time, actually. It's called Strange Indiana Monsters, and has been released recently by Schiffer Books. Now, I was surprised to find out that Indiana actually has an enormous variety of cryptozoological animals, ranging everything from lake monsters to serpents to Bigfoot. So it's a very, very interesting book. And our guest, Michael Newton, has written actually more than 200 books on a wide variety of topics. And this is his fourth book on cryptozoology. He was awarded the American Library Association's 2006 Outstanding Reference Sources for Small and Medium-Sized Libraries for his book, The Encyclopedia of Cryptozoology, A Global Guide to Hidden Animals and Their Pursuers. He is a cryptozoologist columnist for Mysteries Magazine, and his book, Strange Indiana Monsters, again, is his fourth book on cryptozoology. Now, this is a call-in show, so if any of you have questions for our guest, please feel free to call in at 877-270-8714. I'll repeat that one more time, 877-270-8714. But now let's just get right to our guest in this very, very interesting book. Michael, thank you so much for coming onto the show.
Well, my pleasure.
Now, wow, 200 books. What made you get interested in writing about cryptozoology? Because that's definitely a strange subject.
Well, back when I was young, 1957 or 58, I was in the Cub Scouts, of course, almost obligatory in those days, and the Boys Life magazine that they put out ran a couple of articles about the Loch Ness Monster and the Abominable Snowman, and it was the same year that Bigfoot in California picked up his famous nickname after the some incidents there around up at Willow Creek, where things were tampered with at the roadbed, road building site. So I've just been collecting things on strange and unknown creatures ever since.
Wow, huh? It's very interesting. You know how you started your book, I thought was very interesting, because dividing up the types of cryptozoological animals.
Well, I thought that would be the best way to go, because if you just put everything in chronological order, it gets to be quite a mess. You know, you have a Bigfoot pop up here, and the next thing you know, you're in a lake looking for something, and it can get very confusing, not only for the reader, but for me.
Right, right. Well, I mean, also, I mean, that there's not only, like, Bigfoot, but species that are out of place, animals.
Oh, absolutely.
Animals.
Well, that's the, you know, going back to the beginnings of cryptozoology, there have been, which, of course, the term simply means the study of hidden animals, as defined by the Belgian zoologist Bernard Heuvelman, who coined the term back in the late 50s. So it can cover not only animals that are unknown to science, like Bigfoot, but those that are thought to be extinct, even though people still report them, and also creatures that pop up, you know, thousands of miles from where they should be, like kangaroos in the American Midwest, for example.
Right, right. Well, that's what was so fascinating about your book, I mean, because you list, like, 807 known species of the wild vertebrates and, like, 208 fish and all of this, and yet it turns out it's a very inexact science because they keep changing their minds, and here are these, you know, strange animals continuing to be reported.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, the I found looking around the country, the various state wildlife departments under whatever name, they appear to be very precise in listing everything that lives within a particular state. But then if you get out and do field work and look around, you'll find that people are catching or killing all kinds of animals that shouldn't be there. And some of the animals thought to be dead many years ago are still reported on an almost daily basis. Like in Indiana, for example, cougars and black bears supposedly have been extinct since the 1850s, and yet every time you turn around, there's a new report in the paper of one or the other being seen.
Right, or gray wolves in 1908, or porcupines.
Absolutely.
As well?
Yep, all the different things, well, not all of them, but many of the different creatures that the state is positive have been wiped out just keep popping up as if they haven't been able to read the guidebook.
Well, do you suppose they're just traveling and moving back in, or that they've always been there?
Well, there's certainly one possibility. The wolves could, of course, make their way down from Michigan or Canada, and some people in the state that have kept various exotic cats as pets, even though it may be illegal. In fact, this afternoon I was out at the exotic feline rescue center where they have 185 lions, tigers, cougars, and black panthers that have been confiscated from illegal owners or, everything from, drug dealers that like to keep a tiger in the basement or so on. So you never really know. But the state authorities still keep saying none are breeding in the wild, even though the cougars have been seen with cubs. So it remains a mystery.
And it's very, very strange. It's fascinating as well. I mean, like, you have this whole chapter on giant snakes, right?
Oh, right, yeah. Some of those reports go back to the 19th century, and you hear of someone who claims they've killed a 19-foot long rattlesnake. Well, according to science, no such thing exists or ever has existed anywhere in the world. And of course, going back that far, nothing was preserved. You'll read little newspaper reports about, the skin is being shipped off to a museum in Chicago, but they never say which one, and there's never any trace of what happened to it. So you don't know if it's something that was just made up by the papers or if it really happened and the evidence was just sadly lost.
Right. Well, evidence like that seems to have a way of disappearing. A lot of folk, and there's a lot of stories, but you never seem to see the body or the evidence.
Oh, absolutely. And I noticed the same thing. I've enjoyed reading your book, Supernatural California, and it's very often, wherever you go around the world or around the U.S., some people think there is a paranormal aspect to cryptozoology as well. I've heard it said that maybe some of these things pop in from other dimensions, and, who knows, really.
Yeah, well, the longer I study it, the less I think that that's so. I mean, it seems to me that these are real animals in a lot of cases, at least. I mean, here's this one case you have on June 23rd, 1952, where this guy saw an 18-foot blue-gray snake crossing the highway.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And I tend to agree with you that the majority of these could well be flesh and blood creatures. We have reports all over the country, of course, of Bigfoot's tracks that, when you examine them closely, they appear to have the dermal ridges just like human fingerprints or footprints, which would be almost impossible for somebody to fake with a carved wooden foot. I have a tendency to lean away from the fourth or fifth dimension explanation. I think some people get frustrated and say, well, I've never been able to catch one, so he must zap into the fifth dimension just when I come around the tree or something, but I'm not sure I buy it.
Right. Well, there are a few cases, and you listed a couple in your book, where there's UFOs around during sightings of, like, Bigfoot.
Well, that's true, too. Nationwide, there have been cases. Nobody ever quite sees Bigfoot getting into or out of the UFO, but they see something in the woods, a large unexplained creature, and then soon after, or sometimes the reports, it's a matter of days or weeks, they see these unexplained lights in the sky and put two and two together. Now, I don't know whether they're coming up with four or seven on that, but again, an unexplained mystery and a lot of fuel for speculation.
Right. It's really interesting. Well, a lot of these out-of-place animals you think might be exotic pets who have been released?
Well, that certainly could be the case, especially when you look at something like an emu or a wallaby, a kangaroo, something like that. And if people are owning exotic animals illegally and one of them gets away, or even worse, if they just got tired of it and turn it loose to try its luck on their own in the wild, then they're not going to rush in and report or confess and turn themselves in and face a fine. There's been speculation to that degree even in Australia and England, where they see black panthers and so forth, that it may be owners that are turning them loose to avoid a fine or a special tax on exotic animals.
Well, maybe enough have been released for them to start establishing a population and reproducing.
Well, I think that's entirely possible. We get a lot of reports of so-called black panthers around Bloomington, Indiana, not too far from where I live. And, you know, I don't see any reason why a pair, for example, has been released into the wild. Why couldn't they breed? I mean, the other animals do. So.
All right. Well, black panthers aren't an officially recognized species in Indiana.
Right. No. Yeah, that's exactly right. I know if we go around the country, for example, they admit now in Florida that they have pythons and breeding in the Everglades, and they've found specimens there up to 20 feet long, but they still don't list them as a species. Of course, not native to the state, but you won't even find them on the list for the Florida Department of Wildlife. But if you ask them, they'll admit, yes, we have pythons. We have 5 and 6 foot monitor lizards from Africa running around Florida because people have let them go, and it's warm, and you know, next thing you know, they're popping out eggs.
Well, Florida's supposedly the only state that has native alligators in it. You have a whole chapter here on alligators there in Indiana.
Yeah, the alligators are very strange.
Are those released pets, you think?
Well, it's a curious question. If they were small, I would be inclined to say yes, but some of them have been quite large, 5 and 6 feet long, and there was one summer in the 90s when they caught 4 or 5 different alligators out of the White River, and it just, you know, it makes me wonder, is there somebody out there that has a secret alligator farm and keeps throwing them in the same river? I just don't know. Our winters should be cold enough to kill them off, but yet they keep recurring every spring and summer, and in the larger ones, it's hard to believe somebody's smuggling them up from Florida just to drop them in the lake.
All right. Well, does Indiana have large wilderness areas? I mean, it must.
Well, yeah, there's we have several quite large state parks, and they've produced more than their share of the Bigfoot sightings. We don't have anything on the scale of the Everglades, for example. But there is wild territory out there. Now, you have hunters crawling all over it, and they're, of course, the ones that report very often sightings of cougars or the so-called extinct bears and so forth.
Right, right. Well, very interesting. Well, tell us about the so-called Beast of Busco. This, I thought, was a kind of interesting story.
Right. Well, the town of Churubusco, Indiana, which they've abbreviated as Busco, this creature was also nicknamed Oscar. Back many, many years ago, there was a private lake owned by a guy named Oscar Fultz, F-U-L-T-Z, and he was a farmer, named the lake after himself, no huge surprise. But he started reporting sightings of a giant turtle in this lake, which was basically a man-made lake. And that came as sort of a surprise to everyone, the first report being in 1898, and then again, I think, in 1914 or 15, and then no one heard anything about it until 1947, when the turtle apparently showed up again, and they began a whole elaborate hunt for it. Several times they tried to drain the lake, and before they could get all the water out, their equipment would break down and so forth, and then you had some people that came along and tried to smuggle a sea turtle into the ocean, of course, with no good result for the turtle, since it doesn't live in fresh water. But apparently the turtle got away, if in fact it was ever there. Some people claim they harpooned it, and it dragged their boat around and then broke the line and escaped, not once, but several times. They still celebrate the turtle days there in Churubusco every spring, and have little turtle floats, and so, well, I should say big turtle floats in their little local parade. But most of the speculation seems to be that it might have been an alligator snapping turtle, which grows to quite a large size, that someone had brought up, or it had found its way up through the river system from a southern state.
Wow.
What became of it, no one can say.
Well, I've heard that, like sea turtles, there have been reports of sea turtles much, much larger, like 10, 20 feet across.
Oh, yeah, yeah, absolutely, yeah. What one would be doing in an artificial Indiana landlocked lake would be even a greater mystery than the beast that was supposed to be there.
Wow, wow. Well, it's amazing to me. I mean, like, you've also got reports of lions running around.
Oh yeah, sure. We have the full range of so-called alien big cats. Black panthers are among the more prominent, but yeah, lions will pop up. 1948, there were reports of a lion traveling with a black panther, and they were seen all over eastern Indiana, or western Indiana rather, and over into Illinois as well. seemed to be making the rounds, and they were sighted by police officers as well as farmers and hunters and so forth. Nobody was ever able to run them down. They supposedly attacked and damaged a police car at one point by running into the door and ramming it with their head. But why a panther and a lion would be traveling together again is anybody's guess. There's been some wild theories about it, but again, they just sort of wandered on to some other hunting ground, apparently.
Well, you have listed here like 27 sightings of black panthers in Indiana alone.
Oh, absolutely, and they've continued since the book came out. Yeah, our most recent one was in August 2007, so they're still being seen.
Wow.
Again, none of them have been trapped or shot yet, but they show up, and some people claim that they've mauled dogs or carried off domestic cats and chickens and so forth.
Right, right. Well, you know, I've also studied cryptozoology for California, as you mentioned in my book, and I was surprised to find out how many lakes we had with lake monsters. And I
thought
that
really
was kind of unique, but now I'm finding out that pretty much they're all over the world in the United States, and of course in the
absolutely. I mean, whether every inhabited continent, well, I guess I would say every continent except Antarctica, which really shouldn't have any solid, you know, the lakes that aren't frozen, but wherever you go, people think about Nessie in Loch Ness. They may know of Champ in Lake Champlain, maybe Ogopogo up in Okanagan Lake in British Columbia. But almost every state in America has at least some claim of a lake monster. Many of them haven't been seen in a long, long time, and some go all the way back to Native American legend. But, yeah, they pop up. It's a surprising number as you go across the country. Some books list hundreds of lakes for the U.S., 20 or 30 lakes probably in Michigan alone that claim to have monsters.
Wow. Well, we have like four here. About that I know of, at least four or five.
Yeah, I'm familiar with Lake Elsinore, and I think there are a couple others.
Right, but you have one here listed, Lake Manitou.
Oh yes,
that's a very interesting story with this giant. Well, what would you call it? A sea serpent?
Yeah, they referred to it as a sea serpent, even though it. Many of the newspaper reports from the 1890s and so forth refer to sea serpents when they're talking about creatures in lakes, which of course is sort of a misuse of the term, but all the way back to before settlers arrived, of course, Manitou in the Native American dialect means devil, so they're basically Manitou Lake means devil's lake, and that probably had something to do with the very early reports of a large unknown creature swimming around out there. But, you know, the sightings in that case go back to 1838, and some of them have continued as recently as the early 1980s,
right,
from the same lake.
This thing is allegedly like, what, 60 feet long?
Yeah, according to some of the reports, yeah, you get a wide differential in the different reports from people, and you have to wonder, were they estimating the size correctly? Were they so excited that they greatly exaggerated, and we just don't know. But there have been reports of it, for you know, tugging, you know, rowboats or fishermen's boats around the lake and so forth.
Wow. Well, some of them I've seen the head come out of the water and said it's like, what, 3 feet across or something?
Yeah, quite
a report.
Yeah, many people would say, well, maybe it's exaggerated, but you have local people who presumably know the wildlife in their area. And, you know, they see something like that, and then you have to wonder how close were they. In some cases, you might wonder if they were even sober, but when you have a huge number of reports from the same area, I tend to think that there must be something. But I couldn't begin to pin it down as far as a species. I mean, there was speculation that it might be one of the paddlefish best known from the Mississippi River, but certainly none of them are going to grow up to 60 feet in length. I think the largest one on record weighed about 115. Well, I think one claimed that it might have been 200 pounds, and the record length is about 7 or 8 feet, so maybe 10% of the reports on that creature that's been seen.
Right. Well, everyone, you're listening to UFOs and the Paranormal Over Our Heads. I'm your host, Preston Bennett, and our guest is Michael Newton, author and cryptozoologist. We're talking about his very interesting book, Strange Indiana Monsters. which is available from Shipper Books. Now, do you have a website or anything you'd like to?
Yes, I do. It's www.michaelnewton.homestead.com.
Okay, that's easy to remember. Michaelnewton.homestead.com.
Yep.
Okay. Now,
or they can just Google me.
It's amazing the number of lakes you have, like Cedar and Bass Lake from 1881 to 1993.
Right, and a couple of those, they even changed. We had originally two Cedar Lakes, and one of them changed names to Bass Lake, or maybe it was the other way around, so that got a little confusing as well in some of the historical reports.
Oh, okay, so it's the same lake?
Well, we have, at one point we had two Cedar Lakes, I believe it was. The one where the sightings were in August 1893 was originally called Cedar Lake, and later it changed to Bass Lake. And now we also have another lake called Cedar Lake. So, and some of the newspaper reports said it was seen in Cedar Bass Lake, which doesn't exist by that name. So there are, in fact, two different lakes. But
right.
And then it confuses even worse. Some people say they're connected by underground streams. So.
Well,
it gets kind of strange.
Certainly a possibility. I mean,
I've heard that kind of thing over dealing with Loch Ness too. That they think some of the lochs in the Scottish Highlands may be connected, but nobody has ever proved it by any kind of sounding device, or much less digging down or drilling.
Right, right. Well, someone should definitely do that. Well, there was a very interesting case that occurred on the Cedar/Bass Lake, which I thought was really fascinating, because this creature actually, they tried to catch it, and it
right.
surfaced, and they pulled it in. It was like 40 feet long, 3 feet in diameter, with a huge head, and it attacks the boat.
Yeah, and the curious thing about that, if this is the one, I believe, where the people on board the boat included the county sheriff and a couple of local lawyers, one of whom, ironically,
right.
had defended the assassin of President Garfield a bit earlier, and they claimed that they were dragged around the lake by this thing after they hooked it for about a half hour.
Right, lawyer George Scoville.
Right, and so they were, it's hard to believe that three or four upstanding people like that in the community would go out of their way to lie about something that's going to make them look ridiculous. At least that's the way I feel. Now, today in the Jerry Springer age, some people will say anything, to get publicity. But in these days, public officials and so forth, whose word was their bond, et cetera, I don't know what they saw, but I'm inclined to think they saw something.
Right. Well, this was, over 100 years ago, too, right? So
right.
It's possible these creatures still existed back then when there was a lot less, development. And
well, that's true. Destruction. Sure, we didn't have the pollution. It wasn't as overrun with people as it may be now. No particular reports from that lake that I'm aware of since about 1893. So whether the creature or creatures died off or moved elsewhere, hard to say.
Right. Well, you've got another report from Horseshoe Pond of this farmer, Isaac Daines, who battled this or tried to capture the serpent.
Right. And it was interesting, when I researched that online, I found that the sketch that they had put in one of the local newspapers actually depicts him being chased on land, not on the water, by something that seems to be, if you look at the end of its tail, it appears to be a rattlesnake about three or four times the size of a man.
Oh, yeah.
And he's running away with something in his hand there that looks like he may have snatched a rattle from it as well. So I think that was some newspaper artist's overexcited imagination. But Daines reported an encounter with a large sort of serpentine creature again back in 1892, which he tried to kill but wasn't able to.
Right. I love the fact that your book has all these pictures and photographs as well, and really brings the stuff to life.
Well, yeah, I got lucky on some of the artwork for creatures that don't stand still for photographs. A friend of mine down in Arkansas named Bill Rebsamen, who does a lot of art related to cryptozoology, and then also supports his family on the side by doing portraits of other wildlife and people. So he's illustrated, this will be the third of my books that he's provided some pictures for, and I'm always happy to be able to make a deal with him.
Right, right. Yeah, well, I work with my sister-in-law, actually, to illustrate some of my books, so.
Yeah.
It's always very nice to have an artist. Well, you've got another, you know, these giant lake monsters aren't really relegated only to the 1800s by any means, because you've got a case here in Big Chapman Lake from 1934 where this, let me see, this guy describes this very large fish-like creature, or serpent-like creature, with a head 2 feet wide and, quote, large cow-like eyes, which I found particularly fascinating because that's how these sea serpents off the California coast here are described, with giant eyes as big as, like, hamburger buns.
Right. Well, and that's one thing that led, earlier I mentioned Dr. Heuvelmans, who coined the term cryptozoology, and back in the late 60s he wrote a book about, called In the Wake of the Sea Serpents, analyzing some 600-odd cases going back to very early times, the 13th or 14th century, and he concluded that many of these reports might describe not a reptile, even though they're described as sea serpents, but it might be some kind of large mammal, whether some kind of giant elongated seal or something on the nature of a giant otter, because many of them appear to describe creatures that have hair or fur of some kind, in some cases even whiskers, and as you say, the large bovine eyes that really aren't characteristic of a reptile at all.
Huh, that's true. I've never... Well, I still tend to think that they're just some sort of extinct dinosaur-type animal that's been around ever since. It's just,
well, that may well be, too. When Dr. Heuvelmans went through all of his reports and tried to sort them out, he actually came out with like 8 or 9 different types of different sea monsters that he thought might exist, and a couple of them were reptiles, and he thought one might be a giant eel, and he thought 2 or 3 others were mammals of some sort unknown to science presently, and one looked rather like a giant turtle. Of course, there was in ancient times prehistoric turtle that was larger than a man, the Archelon, which some people think still may survive out in the distant oceans. It would be nice if we were able to find something along those lines and bring it in, but it's also nice to have a mystery sometimes.
Right, right. Well, this is interesting, I mean, because you don't describe only lake monsters. There's accounts of octopuses, which I guess most people probably don't know, but they're only... survive in saltwater, in the oceans. Is that right?
Right. Well, they are exclusively saltwater creatures, supposedly, but there have been a couple of cases, well, in 1999 at a place on the Ohio River called Falls of the Ohio State Park. An octopus was found dead on shore, and it was photographed. It definitely existed. Still no idea whether somebody dropped it there as a joke, or, you know, if it's somehow they've evolved to live in fresh water. After this book came out, in early 2007, another octopus was found on shore at almost exactly the same place, and it was slightly larger. When they started to look into that, they found out, they did have a guy that came forward and claimed that, I'm trying to remember the details now, he either threw it out dead, or I believe he had it in captivity, and released it into the river, and of course it couldn't exist there for long. But still no idea where the one in 1999 came from. And there have been other reports up and down the Ohio River going on even into West Virginia of similar things back to the 1950s. So can't rule out the fact that there might in fact be a freshwater octopus species.
Right, right. Well, you have a picture of one right here in the book with its big old eyes staring out at you.
Yeah, that's the one from 1999, and it was taken. Paul McLean, the photographer, was a park employee there who also photographed the second one earlier this year, and people can find photos of that one online if you Google, I think, octopus and Kentucky, because it was found right there on the border between Indiana and Kentucky.
Right, right. Okay, well, let's talk about this kangaroo, so-called kangaroo flap. Now, kangaroos are native only to Australia, is that right?
Australia and New Zealand are the only place you find kangaroos and wallabies naturally, although they've been, they have a colony in England where some well-meaning folks brought wallabies in the early 20th century and let them go, and they've managed to survive in a few pockets there in northern England and Scotland. but they definitely shouldn't be hopping around the American Midwest. No.
But you said they've been appearing there since at least 1899.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the original reports go back that far, which is almost, well, of course, Australia was discovered, so somebody could have brought one over. But, yeah, our big flap here originally was 1974, and then some more popped up in 2005. And, again, whether they're escape pets, no zoos or private collections that are licensed by the state had any kangaroos missing in either year. Whether somebody had black market kangaroos and they got away, we don't know, but they've been seen not only in Indiana, but all over the Midwest at different times, and even down into the border south, Tennessee and so forth.
Right, well, your November 1974 flap was like right after a number of reports in Illinois and Michigan, so.
Right, and it makes you wonder whether it's one kangaroo moving around through these different states that border each other, because Michigan, of course, just sort of north of us, and Illinois to the west, so it could theoretically be one kangaroo, or it could be a group of them that I suppose would be breeding somewhere. Since none of them were ever actually captured or killed, it's hard to say if they were impossible to say if it was the same animal or not.
Right. Well, it's very, very interesting. Now, my favorite chapter, I think, was your chapter on Bigfoot.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I mean, I like the Lake Monster chapters. Well, it's all actually really good right to the end, which where it gets really bizarre, which is amazing. But you found, a total of 135 reports.
Yes, and which really surprised me because you don't expect to hear a Bigfoot at all in Indiana, but going all the way back to, I believe 1839 was the earliest report I've been able to dig up, and 135 that I'm sure of to the end of 2006.
Wow, so.
And they're scattered all over the state. It's, you think of Bigfoot, you think of the Pacific Northwest out your way and so forth, Northern California up through Oregon and Washington into B.C. But, in fact, I believe now every American state except Hawaii has at least one Bigfoot report on file, and some of them have hundreds and hundreds. Pennsylvania, supposedly, according to author Rick Berry, has over 350 Bigfoot sightings. Which is almost hard to credit, but, the reports are made, whether the sightings are true or not.
Right. Well, California is apparently one of the leading producers of it.
Oh, yeah, no question about that. Yeah, and I think you have some of the very earliest reports, too, at least. Of course, all over the country, Native Americans have known about this forever into prehistoric times, but I'm sure California has some of the very earliest cases from the European settlers.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, here's an interesting report you have where this lady puts out food for the
right.
Bigfoot. And,
a number of families claim, individuals or families claim to have had, I won't say a relationship, but ongoing sightings of one or more Bigfoot going on for years. And they're usually in some rural setting, and they'll say that Bigfoot comes around snooping around their house or their barn. And the one lady, like you say, that claims that she can put food out and they'll come almost on command. She's never had the foresight to snap photos or pick up a video camera, but it's her story anyway, so I report it for what it may be worth.
Right. Well, it's interesting. You have this one case where some predator killed 60 chickens.
Oh, yeah. There are the occasional reports, and these get blamed on Bigfoot in some cases. When he's not even seen. In other cases, people claim they have seen the actual Bigfoot or Sasquatch in their yard attacking dogs, chickens, ducks, down in Mississippi, or I guess it was Arkansas, where they have the supposed Boggy Creek Monster. There's a report of it snatching a full-grown pig and leaping over a fence and running off into the woods. So the actual attacks are rare. But the reports are out there, and it leads to speculation that Bigfoot may have a well-rounded diet like human beings instead of just living on nuts and berries.
Right. They're like omnivores.
Yeah, I think it's most logical for their survival. especially in the different kinds of environments where they crop up.
What about like this odor of Bigfoot? How would you explain that, just out of curiosity?
Well, you know, I am very curious about that. You find that reported all over the world that they seem to have a foul smell or be in a thundering need of some roll-on deodorant. Down in Florida, in fact, their Bigfoot, its main nickname is a skunk ape. But all over from where you are, not only across the United States to the Yeti in the Himalayas, oftentimes they have a certain air about them, shall we say. And I don't know if that's, I suspect it might have something to do with some kind of musk glands. Maybe it's a way to find each other out in the wilderness, whether it's at mating time or... It's hard to believe that they're just filthy because their normal bear doesn't stink or whatever if you happen to be close to one.
Right, right. And not all accounts actually involve this odor either.
No, that's true. In many cases, an individual like a hunter will be walking along and just look up and there Bigfoot is. On the other hand, you have quite a number of reports where people don't see Bigfoot at all or even see a footprint, but they smell a foul odor out in the woods and assume it was Bigfoot. And, of course, in many of those cases, I think it might have just been a dead animal carcass or stagnant water or something, and they got a little carried away with their imagination.
Right, right. Well, it's very interesting. And
probably shouldn't insult him too much until we've had a chance to at least be introduced and say that they all stink, you know, and are running around diseased or something. I don't think that really adds up. But it's definitely gotten into the Bigfoot folklore that a lot of them smell.
All right. Well, let me ask you, is Indiana a mountainous state? Is it very forested?
Well, up in the central and northern part, it tends to be more flat. Now, down where I am in the south central part of it, we have hills here, but there's nothing really, certainly nothing to compare with your mountains out in California or farther east here. There's nothing at all like the Rockies or the Appalachians east of where I am. You know, a hill here a couple of hundred feet high would probably be a good-sized hill for us. So you don't have anything, no reports of Bigfoot living up on the peaks where the snow never melts or anything like that.
Right.
No.
Right. Well, because I heard that Bigfoot reports are most common in forested mountain areas.
So. Oh, sure. Yeah, and we still tend to have the majority of ours from woods. But not so mountainous. I mean, the ones down here in the southern part of the state around where I live and over around Bloomington are from, I would say, hilly areas. But it's nothing where you'd need to be any kind of a serious mountaineer to get up and down the hills. You know, you should be in shape, but you're not going to need any pitons or anything like that to climb.
Right, right. Well, I'm sure you're familiar with Linda Godfrey's book. As a cryptozoologist, her book on...
Oh, love them. Yeah.
Very, very interesting. Do you have any werewolves going on in Indiana?
Well, we have some going back into history. None that are presently said to be prowling the woods, but from the days when some of our early settlers were French trappers back in the 18th century, there were reports of not only shapeshifters into wolves, but into other things. I mean, one kind of odd story that I came up with without much detail was the claim of a guy who could change into pumpkins. So I would have been kind of hard for him to get around and threaten anybody, I guess. Maybe if he was up on the barn roof, he could roll off and hit you on the head. But claims of individuals that could change into horses and so forth, a wide variety of creatures. But we've had nothing, certainly in modern times, nothing on the scale of the reports covered in Godfrey's books, like The Beast of Bray Road or some of those.
Right.
And I guess it's just as well that we don't. I think some of those could be explained in her state and elsewhere by Bigfoot sightings, although some of the other creatures seem to have a very different heads and faces, elongated like a dog's, which
right.
wouldn't match Bigfoot at all.
Well, it's very interesting. I mean, they're certainly related in some way.
Well, I think it's very possible. I mean, how many different kinds of large, hairy, bipedal creatures could be running around in the woods? You know, many people would say none at all, but I'm inclined to think there's probably not three or four or five different kinds of species out there that have never been caught.
Right. Well, if they've never been caught, they're probably pretty intelligent. I mean,
well, yeah, very possibly. I'm not going to be the one to say they're ignorant, especially if there are some people think, you know, a form of primate, like a more highly developed ape. I mean, the more they study chimpanzees and orangutans and so forth, they're not that far off from us intelligence-wise.
Right, right.
In fact, I've met some people I think didn't measure up to a chimp, but that's another story.
Well, you know, what's interesting is you've got, I mean, as you approach the end of the book, where you're kind of able to digest some of the more outlandish stories, you find that some of these early accounts are real. There's a lot of really early accounts of these flying dragon-type creatures.
Yeah, they pop up all over the country, too. I was interested in the one, well, way back to 1879 here, a character up near Fort Wayne who claimed that he had a fight with like a 40 or 50-foot, well, actually, he claims he measured it at 34 feet 3 inches, which was pretty specific, and that he managed to kill it out there in a field with his little his scythe and getting it to fall on some farm machinery. Of course, that's another case where they were going to preserve it and ship it off to Chicago, and it never got there. So it remains unknown.
And here's something I've never heard of, actually, is mud mermaids.
Yeah, that was an odd one, and it actually fell into my hands at the last minute when the book was almost done back in 1894. The curious part about this, well, the witnesses claimed that they found these two creatures. They called them mud mermaids, but the way they described them almost was more like a cross between a reptile and a person. And they claim that they were pulled out of the Ohio River, as I say, or someone brought them there, and they were put on display. But the odd part is that none of the reports actually came from an Indiana newspaper. They were reported by newspapers out of Ohio. And that always makes me wonder a little bit where the information came from. Of course, once again, the specimens were not preserved and so forth. So whether it was even true or not is unknown. But if they did exist, they'd be a very mysterious species unknown to science.
Well, it's just bizarre. I mean, you've got this other one, the Puckwudgie of 1927.
Yeah, the name actually goes back to Native American legends, and it's the English version of Indian terms that means like little man of the woods or even little Indian. But to see them pop up in 1927 was a surprise, especially when they came out of the woods not looking like a hairy little ape or anything, but wearing a blue robe. And almost like, I think then you're getting into leprechaun territory. And only reported by the one or two witnesses at any time in Indiana history. So you never really know if he was pulling a fast one or if he saw something that's so different that it might not even fit with cryptozoology as an animal, but be some sort of pygmy human.
It's just bizarre. I mean, it really isn't. I'm not going to doubt these people. I mean, it may be true, it may not.
But well, you know, I wasn't there, so I'm not.
I mean, his story is not unique, is what I'm saying.
No, that's true. Yeah, you move around the country and around the world, and you get the accounts of the little people everywhere you go, all the way back into recorded history.
Right. Well, you know, now, when reading your book, on page 107, I was really shocked to see this photograph of a teratorn.
Oh, right.
Giant bird, which looks, I don't know, like a crow, only it's 50 feet across.
Yeah, I think it's supposed to be more closely related to a condor or an eagle, but of course this is a model that's been recreated from the skeleton. They've never actually found the feathers.
Oh, okay.
But this was a model that they made, and the remains of the really large ones have only been found down in South America. So this is a reconstruction that was made for the museum. But some people believe that this species from prehistoric times may be the Thunderbird of Native American legend. And again, reports of very, very large birds, different parts of the United States, Illinois, they were supposedly trying to snatch children in the 1970s. There have been reports of them seen over Texas and Alaska in this century, like 2004 and 2005.
Really, you know what? I know someone really well who finally revealed to me his sighting of this giant Thunderbird type thing.
Okay.
Which took place actually in, let me see, it would be Illinois in the late 1960s.
Okay.
Or maybe early 1970s, which is funny because you mentioned that exact time. And he,
right.
I've known him forever, and he finally told me that he was outside one day as a very young kid when he saw this giant bird with a 50-foot wingspan. And he never, ever told a living soul because he couldn't believe his eyes. But he said it flew by, and that was it.
Well, you get reports of, in some cases, again, they come in these flaps where there'll be dozens of reports for a short time from one area, and it's not uncommon to hear witnesses compare these birds in size to a Piper Cub, for example, or other small private planes, which is larger than any bird known to be presently living.
Right. Well, this guy I know won't talk about it now, and he won't even talk about it.
Well, to me, that's a fairly good indication that he's not somebody just trying to get his name out there for a practical joke or a quick buck.
Right. Well, you've got this account here which occurred in Indiana dating at 1946.
Right. And that's the last one from our state that I was able to run down, but many others, much more current. As I say, Pennsylvania has been another hot spot of these in an area that they call the Black Forest, no relation to the Black Forest in Germany. But, yeah, throughout history, they weave in and out of, they pop up here and there. And, you know, you never know where you're going to see one. Hopefully, you know, if they're not hungry when they see you, because some of these at the maximum known size could carry off not only a child, perhaps an adult.
Well, you know, that would be something to see. I mean, not to be carried off, but just to...
Right, yeah, I'd want to be watching from the ground instead of getting the bird's eye view.
Well, now, here's another really bizarre incident you talk about, which is the Dogtown Lizard Man in 1955.
Yeah, now that was a strange one, and I have the Lizard Man in quotes because it was sort of an assumption that was made by another writer who's been at this longer than I have and whose work I respect, Mr. Lauren Coleman out of Maine. But this was a case in August 1955 of a couple of women swimming in the Ohio River near Dogtown, so it may be an unfortunate name, but they're swimming along, and one of them feels that something grabbed her foot as if it was trying to pull her down under the water. And she described the hand as feeling as if it had a furry or a hairy palm, which to me doesn't really scream Lizard Man. But years later, when Lauren Coleman and his co-author Jerome Clark wrote about this in 1978, so it's almost 25 years after the event, he described the hand as scaly. And went from there to hook it up to reports of other so apparently reptilian humanoid creatures seen from South Carolina and Texas. And I think he may have kind of made a leap of faith there that was unjustified, but I didn't know what else to call it, so stuck it in there and reported the controversy.
It's one of those weird, bizarre, unique encounters.
Yeah, and you never know, since the lady in question didn't actually see anything, did she snag her foot on some underwater vegetation? Was it a tree branch? You know, was it Bigfoot out for a swim? I don't know.
Right.
She did not see a lizard man or anything else, but something scared her enough to get out of the river and stay high and dry.
Right. Well, Michael, your book, Strange Indiana Monsters, it's fascinating. I learned a whole bunch, and that's really just...
Well, I'm glad to hear it, and you're no stranger to the field yourself, so
well,
quite a compliment.
I just thought it was really a great read, and we only have...
Well,
like
I appreciate that very much.
Oh, you're welcome. We have like 1 minute left, so do you want to leave our listeners with any last messages about cryptozoology?
Well, I would say, you know, if you can, keep your eyes open wherever you go, because no matter where you live in America, someone within 100 miles or so who's alive today, I should say, has had an encounter with some strange and unknown creature. Could be anywhere. Could be your backyard or down at the mall.
Wow. It's very interesting. It's all over the world.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you, Michael, for coming on to the
show. Well, my pleasure.
It's been great, and I wish you great success with your book, and I'll have to have you on again when you write another book about this
subject
or anything unexplained.
Okay, I look forward to it.
All right. Well, everyone, that's our show for today. You've been listening to UFOs and the Paranormal. I'm your host, Preston Dennett, and our guest today has been Michael Newton, who has written a fascinating book called Strange Indiana Monsters, which has just been released by Schiffer Books. And what is your website again?
It's www.michaelnewton.homestead.com. Or you can just Google me.
Okay. Google Michael Newton, N-E-W-T-O-N, or www.michaelnewton.homestead.
No, just dots, no slashes.
Okay, .homestead.com. Very good. Well, thank you, Michael, again.
Okay, and, thank you. Have a good one.
I hope you've all enjoyed tonight's show, and I hope you can join us next week when our guest is going to be Hope Bradford, and she's going to be talking about her book, The Living Word of Kuan Yin, which is a very, very interesting story about channeling of a higher spirit. So I hope you can join us, and until then, have a wonderful evening.